hope you'll bear with me as I get this microphone on. It is definitely a honor to be here. The cause for which we are gathered is probably the second most important cause of our age. The first most important cause is the cross of Jesus and its proclamation. I think I am here because I was also blessed to speak and give a very similar presentation at the March for Life 2 years ago at the first LCMS National Conference that was there. That was my only experience with the March for Life, and it was tremendous. Nothing stuck out to me so much as how many Roman Catholics there were and how few Protestants there were. And to this day, I still am not sure what that means or how to deal with that or change that. There is no question that we can't stop this fight. And I will talk about some of the numbers and the impact on my generation as we go. But again, let it be said, I'm humbled to stand before you. I get to speak a lot, but this one means more to me than most. We live at a very tumultuous time in Western civilization, something of a perfect storm of cultural climate change. There's a lot in the news today about climate change and polar vortexes and global warming. Those things, I guess, are worrisome if you think the world's going to end before Jesus comes back. That doesn't bother me quite as much as the cultural climate change, the move from a Constantinian church, a culture where church was something people did because it was the right thing to do, to an age which is violently anti-Christian. And at this point in time, not so much physically violent, but emotionally and verbally violent. Technology has exacerbated this. It's made the change go faster than I think it would have in previous generations. Much as the printing press expedited the Reformation, so the television and the internet have expedited Marxism and Nietzscheism and Nihilism, and we'll maybe explain those in a moment, but they have brought about this thing that we call postmodernism. A world after the modern era. What does that mean? It means a world after people stopped thinking that thinking could make sense and decided that we couldn't make sense of it at all, so we'll just do what feels right. That is what Nietzsche, the famous atheist who wrote God is Dead, you know that, right? You've heard that? That was what he came to as his conclusion. Since God is dead, the truly great man is the one who decides he feels something is right and is willing to do it no matter what. That is his Superman. We live in an age where that is the driving morality of every individual on the street. If I feel it's right, then it is right. And if I'm strong enough to make you shut up, then it's okay. The world has also become flat, where these Superman-driven ideas can be sent across the oceans in a moment, where information travels so quickly, minds are changed just as quickly. And behind it all, there is a bit of a secret idea that's floating around. I'm glad there are some pastors out there doing more work on this. Fascism is in vogue these days. Now, when most people say fascism, we think of maybe Hitler, right? Hitler wasn't really a fascist, though. The fascists were in Italy. Fascism gets its name from the word fasci, which is Italian for a bundle of sticks tied together, which would therefore be hard to break. The way we would translate fascism today in America is the word community. Communityism, the worship of the community, or putting one's trust in a community as the answer to all of man's problems. This idea made famous by C. Peter Drucker, of business guruism and eventually the church growth movement, has really infiltrated not only our churches, but then also it is out in the world as well. So what's the end of this? The end is that the meaning of the individual in American culture today is meaningless. You are nothing unless you're part of a tribe. And that tribe you only belong to so long as you fit the group, the community of that tribe, and do as it says. This has tremendous impact on questions like, what is the worth, the value of a life? If an individual does not exist but only as they relate to community, then the community can decide when to get rid of an individual. A question that I know you in this room have been concerned about for 40 plus years now, as we in this country have long decided it's okay to get rid of certain individuals if we don't like them, or don't need them, or if they might get in the way of our life. Come on, work now, please. There we go. Fuel on the fire. This hyper-irrationalism is allowed to exist because of that will to power I spoke of earlier. So when the community decides to do something, or even an individual within that community wants to lead that community in a direction they believe is true, it doesn't even have to make sense anymore. So the other thing we'll see today in American thought is radical inconsistency. Somebody has no problem saying, all we need is to love each other more, and then to get on the phone to her boyfriend and say, I'm so tired of you, you're so needy, I don't want to spend time with you anymore. And they don't see the inconsistency between their worldviews, plural, as they do this. This allows someone to walk in the name of freedom and choice about saying things like, abort the church because it's against my choice. Get rid of those people who would stop me from doing what I want to do. They're hateful, I'm loving. Yeah? The inconsistency is in your face, but it doesn't matter. Because irrationalism is what we live in and breathe with. It's not about thinking, it's about feeling. And if I feel it's right and I'm strong enough to make you not disagree by shouting you down, then you have to listen to me and I am right. So it's come to be that my body, my choice, the way that it's spoken of today, that means that you and I and the baby don't get a choice. And we are to be silenced. Our view of dissent is to be shoved aside. There is a violence inherent in this system, and I think we will see it pressed upon us more and more in coming years. In the end, the value of a life, what's a life worth, ends up being decided by the one who is willing to be loudest about it. And if you've ever been in a room with a group of civilized people, the loudest one is usually the least civilized. We're a little far away from my computer, and the gentleman coming in is standing between us. There we go. But what does constitute quality of life on a planet like Earth? How do we answer that question, right? We'll abort this baby because we're concerned about its quality of life. Well, what does it need to have a quality life? How much money? How much food? How much success? How much happiness? How little pain? And who gets to decide when their body is more important than your body? Who gets to decide when your life now as a living adult doesn't have enough quality to be worth government funds to keep you alive in your olden age? And who's going to stop them when they decide that you do not have enough of a quality life for them to keep it going? My point here is not to raise dramatic fears about Obamacare. It's something that's not my favorite thing, but I wouldn't be here to talk to you about that at all. My problem is the philosophy, again, behind American culture, which has the abolition of the human being as the greatest issue driving its culture of death, that again, the individual human life, no matter who you are, child in the womb, graying-haired old age, or midlife crisis adult, individually, you have no value, you have no meaning. And in the place of this, then, we see a barbaric, heathen, nature-worshipping, totalitarian-leaning, willing-to-lie, inconsistent, brainwashed, emotion-driven mob running our country, running our lives, and in too many places, running our churches. Oh, I got ahead one. There we go. So let's get serious, though, about this value of life. Let's assume we're all atheists for a moment, and we're going to have this civilized discussion about the value of human life and when we should stop a life that's not quality. And let's look at it from the point of view of, you know, what is a human life worth in the world? Whether they're born or unborn, young or old, good looking, ugly, okay, well, how do we fit in this planet where the average adult with a mass around 100 kilograms, maybe a bit less, would mean that the mass of the Earth is about 100 kilograms. The mass of the Earth is 6 times 10 to the 24th kilograms. Now, what does that mean? It means it would take that number, is it 60 trillion? I don't even know. It's bigger than trillion. Trillion is like the one to the right of it. That many average North Americans to have the same mass as the Earth. There's only 6.5 billion Americans on the Earth, and not all are quite 100 kilograms. So the mass of all humans put together represents less than that percentage of the Earth's mass, 0.00000000001%. Put in context, again, think of it this way. The sun is 1 million times the size of the Earth, but the Earth is 1.26 sextillion times the size of the average human. Said another way, the Earth is 1 quadrillion times larger than a human, then the sun is larger than the Earth. So what does that mean? It means Earth is big. It's really big, and no picture can demonstrate just how large it is. But if Earth is big, what does that make us individually? We're quite small. So what's life worth if we're small? Now forget about the unborn just for a moment, humor me in this. What good are you with climate change and war and peace and disease and food and death? What's the point on this rock floating in space? That building, I can't do it because my iPad's not hooked up. That one on that side is the first skyscraper, built in 1873, New York City, the Equitable Life Assurance Building. It was the first building to feature passenger elevators and came in at a whopping 130 feet tall. There must be no end to what man can achieve if we can build a building 133 feet tall. Wasn't even in Kansas City. I'm getting ahead of ourselves. There we go. In 1974, I was born in 1978, by the way, the Sears Tower, then called, was the largest building on the planet, a skyscraper, 1,729 feet tall. That's 13 times 130 feet. Man. We can really accomplish something as humans, can't we, if we put our minds to it? But next to something so big, well, how small does a human get? Moving on. And I apologize for the delay. We're not done yet. We can still become greater. In 2009, the Burj Khalifa in Dubai of the United Arab Emirates came in at 2,717 feet. Cost $1.5 billion to build. I bet you that is a real bargain compared to what it would cost today. But you can see it nearly doubles the size of the Sears Tower once you take away the antennae. How big is a human compared to that, and what kind of quality of life do we need? Is it worth it to kill a human to keep that building here, or should we tear buildings down to keep humans here? And again, if we're just talking about size, why stop with buildings? Why not move on to something like mountains? Mountains are much bigger than we are. They certainly must be more important. Their quality of life can know no pain. In the background there, you can see Japan's Mount Fuji. 12,338 feet tall, or 3,776 meters. It's kind of a pretty sight there, hanging out over the city. If we compare Mount Fuji to our former slide, there we go, of our buildings, you can see that suddenly the scope begins to change when we start thinking about landforms and Earth versus the size of a human and the value of a human. Our Dubai building can clearly be seen as about 1/6 of the mountain's height. You can barely see maybe that little blip that is 130 feet far on the left, the Equitable Life building. Where would you be beside Mount Fuji? And how valuable are you compared to it since you're so much smaller? Mount Fuji, of course, is not a very large mountain. It is quite small when compared to the greatest mountains in the world. In the mountains of Asia, it wouldn't even fit on the map. All of those red ones are mountains in Asia. After that, you have South America, North America, Africa, and so on, with Mount Everest, of course, being the tallest mountain known in the world. Mount Everest, however, is just part of a chain of mountains called the Himalayas. It is really nothing by itself when you compare it to this massive spine of our planet running along the border of Nepal. Seen from space, You can, oh, we're ahead of ourselves. There we go. You can sort of make out the Himalayas there. It's a tremendous amount of land. A human being is entirely lost in this picture. We can go even further out. And you can kind of make them out along the border of India there and Pakistan as well. But now we're getting to the point where we were before, looking at Earth and the size of the Earth and how big Earth is in space. So, well, maybe we can comfort ourselves. Maybe we can say at least the human species, remember we're thinking like atheists, at least the human species can accomplish something on Earth. At least we can gather together as community and make our species stronger than the other species so that we can keep living forward into the future. And after all, there must be many, many other kinds of life out there in the universe that we could get to know. There must be meaning in this somehow. I won't really be able to get into the movie, The Privileged Planet. I would love to recommend it to all of you. It is a film about the likelihood of life existing in the universe. I'll bring it up here again in a moment. But when we start thinking about... There we go. When we start thinking about the size of the Earth in the universe and trying to bring our quality or our value of life from size, things get a little even more out of hand. You might recognize this picture. You can barely see it. It's very famous from 1990, July 6th. There was a machine called Voyager that we'd flung out toward the stars when I was just a young child that just as it was about to pass out of our solar system turned around and took a few shots of the sun and the Earth. And you can actually see the Earth. It's that little tiny blue dot. You can see this kind of ray going along that way. That's a bit of light from the sun. It was really just a refraction on the lens, if I understand it correctly. But that little tiny dot is the Earth taken from beyond Pluto. Remember how big the Earth is, right? Sextillion something? How valuable is life on that little tiny planet, and how would we decide? This next slide will show you where Voyager was when it took the shot in relation to Jupiter and Saturn. And you know the inner solar system gets smaller much more quickly than the outer solar system beyond Jupiter. This next slide, it's really kind of cool stuff, is those two pieces in the middle that are a little more clear. One of them is the shot I showed you a moment ago. If you got in really close to it, you would be able to see the pale blue dot in it. This other piece is a larger shot of the entire solar system that wasn't as a high definition of a shot. And so those places are zoomed in on those precise places as opposed to their relation to the sun. You can see, of course, how big the sun is in that picture. It's quite large in its own right. But then again, I mean, how valuable is the sun in something like space? This is a shot of our solar system, comparatively speaking. Now, the size of the planets themselves is not the scale. It's meant to show you instead the scale of the distance between the planets compared to each other. Again, you can see how tight in the inner solar system is and how with each progressive planet you get further and further out. This is our solar system in its interstellar neighborhood within the Milky Way galaxy. Each dot there represents a full solar system containing stars and planets. Again, it is scaled not to the size of the star, but to the relative distance. There, you might be able to see that a little bit better. And you can see solar Earth where the red letters are right there in the center. And now we're so far back, where's the pale blue dot? And we're so far up, where is Mount Fuji? And we're so far away, where is the Equitable Life Building? And again, who are you in all of this? This is a shot taken directly from the movie I mentioned a moment ago, The Privileged Planet, of the Milky Way from the top. I believe this is an artist's rendition, but you can see there's three spirals going up this way. In the inner one, there's a glow on the inside, right where the black comes down and creates a little bit of space. That glow doesn't actually exist. It's representing the location of our solar system in the Milky Way. And what you'll notice is really quite fascinating that we are located... Oh, did I do that? Oh. have a black slide. Go back to where we were. Okay, go back, there we go. Hopefully we'll be able to go past the black slide at some point. That's scary. We are in space after all, yeah. but I want to get to the Milky Way. No. This one, yeah. All right, so being located inside of that empty space next to the spiral arm, and the spiral arm has a name, it's the Orion. I didn't write down. I think it's the Orion Spiral Arm. The movie and the book, The Privileged Planet, are a non-Christian, necessarily, scientist's confusion about the unlikelihood of the existence of life on any planet in the universe based on the needs of a planet physically to support life. And part of this is our location in the Milky Way. We could not exist in that interstellar area. Planets don't really exist in that inner galaxy area. There's too much star action going on and far too much chaos. Sentient life couldn't survive. We would be blown to bits. And further out, again, you have more stuff going on passing from outside of the Milky Way as well. The inside of the arms themselves, again, there are a lot of nebula and star formation going on. The number of requirements for a planet's position in relation to a star, the size of the sun that we have, once they start doing the math of it all, even though there are billions and billions of stars that they've observed in the universe, it is significantly more trillions of odds that you even have one planet placed like ours is with the requirements needed to have life exist on it. Now, I didn't do a very good job of explaining that. I'm not the scientist. I really recommend you check out the video. I'm sure you can find parts of it on YouTube. It is a fascinating thing. Even so, it's really the argument for intelligent design over against evolution and whatnot, but these are not entirely different ideas. For the evolutionist, again, I mean, what is the meaning of life? If this is all random chance and we all got here sort of out of hand, certainly at the end of the day, if I need to survive and it requires you don't, then I have nothing to stop me from that in a space as giant and vacuous as this with no God, right? Now let's see, there we go. All right. So here is the Milky Way galaxy in its local galactic group. I just love this. It's fascinating to me. I want to know what's in Andromeda. It's that big one over there. Our galaxy, you look at those pictures, you think it must be so huge and Earth is so small, but look at Andromeda. It's like twice, three times the size of the Milky Way. And each one of those little dots up there, that is another galaxy. Some are quite small. They're dwarf galaxies, but those are all galaxies. And again, the space here is representing the distance between these. How vast. How large. We're not done either. Oh, come on. Oh, there we go. This is that local galactic group inside of the Virgo supercluster. So that each one of these is clusters of galaxies. Significantly larger than ours. Look how small ours is. You can't even see the Milky Way in ours. But you've got this Virgo cluster over here for which the whole point is named. It's just massive. All the stars. All that space. More and more. Did I get it? Oh, come on. There we go. There's the Virgo supercluster in the midst of other local superclusters. So those are all superclusters of galaxies, not stars, galaxies. And when they say local superclusters, that's because those are the superclusters that are nearest to our clustered supercluster in this drawback of local superclusters, which itself is a shoot-in from this known universe. Those are all superclusters of galaxies. The universe has some really cool stuff in it. God's personal tribute to the Back to the Future series is one of my favorites. See, God knew it was going to happen, and he put it there for us to find it. Right? But Thank you for laughing. It's meant to be a joke. But in all seriousness, when you look at this, and you think about how large that is, and then you think about how small that pale blue dot was, and that was just within the solar system, and you ask, what is the quality, what is the value of that planet? And what is the value of a mountain? And what is the value of a building? And then what's the value of you and me and a child? A mass of cells that randomly evolved for no good reason whatsoever. At birth, just about the size of a pumpkin. Not very big. And 10 weeks before that, it was the size of a cabbage. And 10 weeks before that, the size of a grape. How do we determine quality? Is it size? Because if it's a matter of size, the difference between that pumpkin when it's born and you and me now, we're in some real trouble when we compare ourselves to the vastness of our universe. And while we're at it, I have another problem, and this is also meant to be a joke. But really, what is it with you people and comparing babies to vegetables? When I was looking for these images, and this actually comes out of when I was tracking our third pregnancy as a family online and trying to see how large the baby was and my wife, and I found all these vegetables, you know, the grape and the cabbage and all this stuff. And I was like, what is this? You know, how is a man supposed to, you know, relate to this? And so I went searching a little bit more. So at 7 weeks, we're back to our size thing, back to seriousness. The baby is just the size of a head on a hammer. Yes. Guys, we can relate to that, right? A little more our thing. That was not at 7 weeks. That was at 10 weeks. There we go. At 7 weeks, then, the baby is about the size of the power button on your TV remote. And at 5 weeks, if you like that, you're going to love this one. My baby is about the size of a BB. Now, sadly, there was no man image for going back to 4 weeks. We had to go back to veggies, the size of a poppy seed. This human being, not even before that visible then to the human eye. What's it worth? What's it worth? And I ask that honestly, if you're an atheist, you're not. The evolutionist, how are you going to argue for your life having any worth? Just because you're bigger? Just because you're thinking now? Because you got money? It comes back to the only answer you have is you got the will to power. You can protect yourself now and that baby can't. Well, that's fine. At least be honest about it then. Don't tell me you're into love and charity and goodwill toward men. Don't pretend that that is true. There is hypocrisy in your system when you will not protect the weakest of our species, which you believe must in fact somehow survive, and instead you kill them. And then when there is outrage and anger over the death of just a few more. December 14th, 2012, Sandy Hook, Connecticut, you may remember it. One man fatally shot 20 children and 6 adult staff, and our nation was outraged. How could this happen? He killed these children. Now, as a Christian, I don't have a problem with this outrage. Observing the postmodern world of power atheism, I think they're a bunch of hypocrites. What do you mean, how could this happen? They're just masses of cells. Living in a material universe that's so large we can't even understand or conceive it. Have you tried being consistent lately? What's the value of 20 people? What does the quality of life matter in a universe as hostile and gigantic as ours, especially from an evolutionary perspective? And let's try to put that in evolutionary perspective. In the grand scheme of things, 20 people is not very much. Let's pretend for a moment that people are pennies. In the history of the world, you would have millions and millions of dollars, and one day we lost 20 pennies. Big deal, right? Who cares? That's what we lost at Sandy Hook. September 11th, 2001, I forgot the date, four? I think that's right. We were, one? Thank you. I was too young to remember so clearly. We were pretty upset over the loss of $30. $30. Seemed like a lot of people at the time, but really, really. I mean, what's a life worth? I mean, really, if you're going to get upset, Hiroshima, you know, we blew up $800. We just blew it up, you know. Why was that okay? And everyone's mad about Auschwitz. I mean, there we had one guy who we know, he was evil. He hated on $10,000 worth of Jews, Poles, Russians, and Christians. So clearly that's wrong. Why? Why? In this grand, giant universe with evolution and the way we got here, randomly, you're really going to sit there and tell me it's wrong. All Hitler did was apply the philosophy most Americans have adopted. That is, Nietzsche's nihilism and the will to power, the belief that all it takes is one person to believe they're right and drive it home. And he believed that his race was the superior, and he put it into practice, and he got rid of those that were standing in the way. Now, of course I think he was wrong, but I'm a Christian. I have a reason to think he was wrong. Our culture doesn't, but we do. What's going on? We have lost $13,000 of people in all the wars the United States has ever fought. And if you talk to an average 20-year-old today, they will see a statistic like this, and they'll say, yes, that's why war is bad. We should make guns illegal, too. But when you talk about abortion, the $500,000 in pennies savagely murdered since 1973 is something that people will stand in the street and cheer for. Now, they can't honestly know that since 1973, the U.S. has only executed with the death penalty 1,295 people. Down with the death penalty, it's so wrong. Since 1973, 44,000 have died in military service. Make love, not war. Since 1973, 1,657,000 people have died in car accidents. We should probably make cars illegal too, I suppose. You can see the others next to them. In that same time period, 54 million abortions. One quarter of every human being conceived, one quarter of an entire generation and a half, one quarter of all Olympic athletes, one quarter of all Nobel Prize scientists, one quarter of people capable of writing great books, making great films, building great buildings, climbing great mountains, searching out great stars. Maybe it would bother us more if they just used guns to do it. I think it would. My point? Notice the hypocrisy inherent in the system. 23 pennies throw a nation into outrage at the horror of life on this pale blue dot because the man used a gun. But the total number of abortions in the United States means 234 abortions per 1,000 live births, 1.2 million a year, 3,000 a day, 137 an hour, 9 every 4 minutes. That means, what, 56 since I started talking, something like that. These statistics include only surgical and medical abortions, because many contraceptive measures are abortifacients, drugs that induce or cause abortions. It is important not to overlook the number of children killed by chemical abortions. Since 1965, an average of 11 million women have used abortifacient methods of birth control in the United States at any given time. Using formulas based on the way the birth control pill works, Pharmacy experts project that about 14 million chemical abortions occur in the United States each year, providing a projected total of well in excess of 610 million chemical abortions between 1965 and 2009. So you tell me, Christian, atheist, what's life worth? You tell me, America, why should any of us be here? And when I tell you that if abortion is not wrong, then neither is my killing you and taking all of your stuff when I feel like it. And then I'll tell you that although I have no reason to believe you won't do that, I won't do that because, as a Christian, I know one human life is worth something. One human life is worth more than all the universe put together. God so loved every human that even though we are arrogant, hopelessly godless, stubborn people, hell-bent on killing our own children throughout our bloody history, He gave His only Son to be destroyed for us in our place. For you. In your place. That whoever believes in Him might not perish, but have eternal life. What does that mean? It means, and there's the picture you can't see, God wants every human being on this pale blue dot for His own. He made the dot. He designed the dot, He placed the dot, and He placed you and me and all our children on this dot. If you want me to talk to you honestly about how to change the mind of Americans about abortion, I don't know how to do it. I really don't. I'm terrified that I have inherited with my generation a nation that will be like this until well after I am dead, if not long before. Sometimes I wonder if the best hope for getting rid of abortion is for Islam to conquer our country. It terrifies me to think that thought. I certainly don't want that thought. But I want an end. I want an end to the massacre. And then I hear about Christians using intrauterine devices. We're not talking the pill right now, about which I have questions. I'm talking about the one they actually put in the womb, which causes abortions. Christians using it because their pastor never told them not to. If we can't win the battle in the church, we're not going to win it on the streets. We're too quiet about this. And when I think about how to fix it, I despair. But I know this. In the church, the answer is always the real hope, the real change, the real life that starts not with you, but with Jesus for you. While I have heard about Christians in my own parish who have used the IUD, I have also been witness to new members sitting in catechism class who advocated abortion at the start of the class and by the end no longer did. And I believe they were willing to hear what we had to teach about the value of a human life and the value of a woman's body not being used to choose but to grow more life because they had first come to this church to hear the Christ-centered, cross-focused preaching about God's forgiveness of sins for everything, from abortions that may have been had by people in this room to those who would commit atrocities like Sandy Hook. Jesus died for all of it. And but for the grace of God, there go I, chief of sinners, though I be. None of you is worse than me. It is that preaching and that gospel and that word and that sacrament by which it comes to us outside of us and so certain, that truth that never changes about a dead man on the cross who became the life of the world, that doctrine that is so practically relevant beyond all we can ask or imagine, that is how minds get changed first. It renews minds and regenerates spirits to hear Christ preached. Because with Christ we see. what a life is worth. Size and quality of life do not matter. Because if a fatherless child born out of wedlock to a teenage mother could do so on purpose as the Son of God with the planned grace to save the world, then we have no business whatsoever calling any human being an accident, a mistake, or a matter of choice. Again, I'm honored to be here. Thank you.